Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today we're going to continue to irritate the cosmopolitan suburban homeowners association style Amerodox characters by talking about a saint that they wish wasn't a saint, and that is Saint Paisius of Hollandar, who died in 1777. But first, I want to wish everyone a happy new year. This new year is going to be better for a lot of people, I think. Today is January 2nd, 2018. And for me personally, this year has to be better for my own mental health. I want to thank everyone who's assisted me. You guys have kept me going in more ways than you realize. What I'm going to do for the new year is for most of my donors, I'm going to send a copy of my latest book, which is the series of essays, revisionist essays on the Soviet Union. And what I'm going to want you to do, you donate money, I'll send you a copy. Now, this book is not in its final form. Therefore, I don't want you to cite it or quote it or in any way for that reason. But if you can, write me back and give me any kind of criticisms, things that I've missed, whatever. So when it is in its final form, it's perfect. And so that's a way to reward you guys, because what I'm saying in this new Soviet book has never been said before. Uncovering things that have never been mentioned before. Things that I've hinted at on this show, and essays that haven't really appeared. It's actually a set of essays rather than one coherent book, although there is a coherent theme. And really the coherent theme is that the Soviet Union had nothing to do with the working class. That was a ruse. Now, you all know that the U.S. and the Western world never opposed Marxism. The Western world is Marxist in many different ways. Marxism was never about equality. Marx hardly ever used the word. It was about different forms of labor. But the point is, the Soviet system had nothing to do with Marxism, and their American so-called opponents couldn't tell you what Marxism was if his rotting corpse fell on their head. And certainly had no idea what Bolshevism was. And this was the case straight up into the 1960s. There was never any Cold War, as you all well know. But if you have two empires of any size on the same planet, at some point or another, they are going to clash. And that's all that was between East and West. Ideology, in terms of ideology, they were identical. They had the same kind of assumptions on the same agenda, especially after World War II. But the question wasn't over ideology. It was simply over one getting too big for the other's comfort. And that's what the Korean War was, the Vietnam War was. The Western world gave away all of Eastern Europe without a fight, which is ironic since the war started over Poland. That surprised Stalin, and yet then sent troops to die in Korea and Vietnam. That's a little odd. And the reason that they were sent there was this was a message from the Western world that you're already way too big, you will grow no farther. It had nothing to do with Marxism or anything else. It certainly was anti-nationalist, it was anti-Russian, but the empire was simply getting too big for American comfort. And the American ruling class realized that if they grew even more, they would then be able to have their own self-sufficient economies and currencies that would not involve the USA. So the idea is that when you trade without restrictions for 70 years or so, support each other in warfare, and train, the Soviet technicians were trained in the US in the 1920s and 30s, there can't be a war. That doesn't make sense. And the details and arguments I've uncovered concerning those two theses about it not being about a worker and the U.S. built it have never been uttered before. So to my donors, I'm going to send a full copy of that book in doc form, really, or probably RTF form, if necessary. And if you can, I'll ask you to please make comments about it so I could incorporate it. So today, St. Paisius the Philetist, as I call him, his real name, though, is St. Paisius of Halandar, a Bulgarian born in 1722. His history of Bulgaria, Slavo-Bulgaria, was published in 1762 and was canonized in 1962, which, by the way, is a little odd because Bulgaria was under the Soviet thumb in 1962. However, while Bulgaria was a model satellite state, far closer to Russia than any of the others, after the death of Stalin, there was this desire to build a Bulgaria separate from the Soviet Empire. And that explains why there's this man suddenly became of interest and why he was canonized in 1962. And he is the Stalin died in the Korean War in 1953. And this, he was canonized 9 years later. This is not a coincidence. Halandar is known on Mount Athos as a monastery for Serbs, but Bulgarians, now they have their own, but most of the Bulgarians, and the line between Bulgarian and Serbian at the time was quite fluid. The last names are usually different. The language is certainly different. Bulgaria uses articles and doesn't have most of the cases as the Serbian has. And the real difference, though, in terms of, you know, figuring out who's who, is if they celebrated the Slava or not. Now, what was this all about? St. Paisius of Halandar was writing at a time, in the 1750s, 60s, 70s. This was a time of an extreme low ebb for orthodoxy in the Balkans. In fact, there was very little orthodoxy in the Balkans at the time. This is something that orthodox historians struggle with. Because if they're going to be strictly canonical about it, there was no canonical Orthodox Church in the Balkans at the time. Thank God, God is not bound to the human canons and does as he pleases. The fact that these bishops were completely phony, not even bishops, these were mostly businessmen, God is not going to therefore condemn the people to hell for that. Since God is not a monster, God is not an animal, the priests and good bishops and priests had what we call supply jurisdiction. They had grace directly from the Trinity as Orthodox people. And of course, the family took over as the main unit of worship, and that's why the Serbian Slava became so important. It needs to be said that the peasantry in Eastern Europe is often and almost always treated as this passive, very ignorant force by the enlightened writers from the Western world. They were not. They were politically astute. They were far more literate than Westerners give them credit for. And they were very shrewd in their dealings with their overlords, especially if they were foreign. They're never to be underestimated. And peasants were already organizing peasant networks based on orthodoxy and nationalism throughout the area in the 18th century. It's also important to note that at the time, no one took the Patriarch of Constantinople seriously. No one. No one believed that he was legitimate. No one believed that he did anything but buy his see. No one believed that he was anything other than an unwilling servant of the Turkish government. That's not the fault of those men who were in that position, but that's simply how it was. If you put the word Philetism into Google, my article debunking that silly so-called heresy is the second thing that comes up. And as I've said many times before, the reason that the 1872 synod that condemned Philetism came into existence was that the Bulgarians were throwing out the completely phony Greek bishops who had bought their sees, replacing them with people who actually spoke the language of the common people in the area, and therefore these Greeks couldn't collect taxes. They went to the Jews at the Phanar for money to buy the see, bought it, and then they needed to tax the population to pay it back with interest. Anything they could take in addition to that was profit. And in kicking them out, they eliminated that possibility. And so Philetism was very quickly, and it was recognized by nobody. No one at the time accepted the 1872 Synod. And the Bulgarian Exarchate was accepted by all of Orthodoxy. And the Patriarch of Alexandria at the time said that this was purely a financial matter. But I have two articles now on the subject, and my very first podcast coming back to the show concerns the Exarchate. They were always in communion with Russia and Serbia and the entire Orthodox world, with the exception of Constantinople. And the Patriarch Anthemius was given a very large bribe to create that so-called heresy. And if it's a heresy, then Paisius of Philander, who was a canonized saint, could not be a saint. That just proves its absurdity. He is a full-scale Bulgarian ethno-nationalist in the same sense that any of us would be for our own ethnicities today. He writes actually in a strikingly modern way. And reading this book, it can be, you know, truly a chronicle of events, which, you know, a lot of it is, you know, kind of boring reading. But his introduction and conclusion is where the meat of the matter is. And his point is to raise a national awareness. It's one thing to have the objective fact of ethnicity. For him, the nation or the ethnic group is based on the language, of course, and the common territory, which taken together creates a family atmosphere. But you have to create the subjective awareness in the population as to being a separate people. Now, it should be noted that around 1700, the Patriarch of Constantinople ordered a burning of all the historical records of the surviving monasteries in Bulgaria. Queen Elizabeth did the same in Ireland. The point being, if they don't know who they are, they can't rebel against it. For him, as well as for the Kolevadis fathers, all saints, the concept was that the ethnic group was tightly connected with religion. Only moderns separate those things, but our forefathers never did. You can't separate ethnicity from religion. The ethnic group comes into subjective existence because of the religion. Without a history, there is no foundation. History is about political liberation. History is about discovering these facts that have been repressed and suppressed by your foreign overlords. The Thanar refers to a group of very powerful bankers, both Greek and Jewish, at the Thanar district of Constantinople, serving the Turkish Empire. Some of them were decent men, that is true, but most were simply rapacious bankers and usurers who served the Turkish government for the sake of collecting taxes for easy profits. They collected rents. They didn't produce anything of value. The Patriarch himself was completely subject to these people. And these are the people who would forward you the money to buy a bishopric, and then you had to pay it back. But the main thesis, if you could reduce him to one concept, the main thesis is that the study of history is the master science. It's the substance of ethics, because whenever you talk about making a choice among different options, it has to be contextualized. No one ever chooses in a vacuum. Study of history itself is an ethical science. There can be no moral choices unless you have a context. The choices that you have available to you are, in fact, contextualized, and that context is the nation. Now, we're talking about ethics in the public sphere, but it exists in the private sphere as well. There's no moral doctrine without the national experience, because that restricts the choices that you have available to you and the mentality that you've developed. This has nothing to do with whether or not the Orthodox Church is universal. Of course it is. But that has absolutely nothing to do with how it's communicated to the population. This was the whole concept. This is why Cyril Methodius was so important and very important to St. Paisius. because in developing and standardizing local languages, this created somewhat of a standardized foundation for missionaries to speak directly to these people. Now, although the Slavs, the Bulgarians in particular, had their histories burnt, were kept illiterate as much as humanly possible, the Greeks would then mock them, calling them ignorant, and say there is no such thing as a Bulgarian nation because there is no subjective awareness of it. You people are just completely ignorant. And of course, being well aware that they're ignorant because of them and their policies. The only thing these people feared was ethno-nationalism. For the same reason, the only thing that the New World Order fears, globalization fears, is nationalism. Marxism is fully supported. Marxists control the universities, for heaven's sakes. Liberalism is fully supported. Neoconservatism is fully supported. Capitalism is fully supported. All of those are cosmopolitan ideology. The one that is not, and the only one that is not, is nationalism. And when you're talking to somebody, don't let them define nationalism however they want. Usually in discussions, most of my debates on this subject end up being something like, you know, here's what nationalism is. It's this confluence of territory and political history and language to create the subjective and objective identity of a people. No one denies that. That's impossible to deny. Language is the reflection of this experience. No one on the planet denies this. Nationalism as such is when there is a politicization of that awareness. That's what it is. It's no more, no less than that. So don't talk to me about, you know, violence or warfare or the state or bureaucracies or anything else. Those are either additions or subtractions to the essence of it. So never let these people define the terms however they want. How dishonest is it that these people will define nationalism as some aggressive, nasty ideology and then pat themselves on the back for opposing it? Don't let them get away with that. There is an actual definition to these terms that these people have no control over. For St. Paisius, nations are the result of the post-flood world, and to a great extent, as to what happened when the Tower of Babylon with Nimrod was erected. The point was to create a single world order and a single world economy based on one language, which existed at the time. Because of this, God struck it down. And to keep any one group of people from ruling the world, he created nations. And these ultimately come from Noah's children, but they were made more real once God commanded this after the destruction of Babylon. You know, the tower is merely a symbol of this new global order. There weren't that many people in the world. They really came from one area. And ruling the entire planet wasn't really that difficult at the time. The titans, so-called, or giants. We still use the term like titans of industry today. Were ruling the earth at the time. And these were demonic forces. They come from the line of Cain, which also created civilization. Now remember, there's a big difference between civilization and culture. As Spengler would say, as Danilevsky would say, as the Slavophiles would say, as Paisius would say. Culture is qualitative. It's about affection. It can't really be analyzed in anything but descriptive words. You can't put a number on it. It's about the national family, the connection of family to create a people. Civilization is another matter. There you're talking about the state or the empire. You're talking about bureaucracies and armies and policemen. In St. Paisius's mind, his view of history is actually a very modern one. The moment the rulers of Babylon were able to subject enough people and extract enough rents from them, they began to control more and more wealth. Well, once that happens, they need a government. They need a state. They need an ideology. They need a way to justify their power over people. St. Paisius says this in 1762. There's a reason this man has been repressed for some time in the Orthodox world, although it's legitimately canonized and accepted by all Orthodox people from all over the planet. I don't care if it was 1962 or not. The man lived a holy life and is the reason there was the Bulgarian national awakening in the following century. And then they developed the concept of cosmopolitanism to justify global rule. When God destroyed the tower and that empire, now you have a far more difficult time of controlling different tribes, because now they're speaking different languages and they're developing different ways of life. Now you have the concept of imperialism. As I've said before, unless there are nations, real primordial nations, then there's nothing wrong with imperialism. Imperialism is only morally wrong if there are nations out there who have a right to self-determination or a duty to self-determination that is being repressed by the imperial power. That's an important concept that's often forgotten in these discussions. So the way Paisius sees Babylon, it's a very modern conception. He sees a centralized global order emerging based on money, charging rents, or in other words, extracting resources based on your political position rather than some economic exchange. And therefore had to control thought, had to control the state, had to create police forces and armies and prisons and everything else to and codes of law and all those things that mark a civilization. And all of those things are quantitative. They're formal. They're institutions of coercion. Formal institutions and non-formal institutions like the family or the nation are two very, very different things. Never allow anybody to try to join the state to the nation. They're not the same. There are plenty of nations that exist without states. For the most part, states are necessary to protect nations. And of course, small states, we've done this on this show for years, that for a small nation, a strong state is absolutely essential, because that is the only force that's able to keep far more powerful entities at bay. And we've talked about, you know, Indonesia and South Korea and Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan and all these other countries on the show over the years, and it's all the same message. The state anchored in the nation is the only way to build any kind of prosperity. Otherwise, you'll just end up being a raw materials exporter for foreign corporations, which, of course, is precisely what they want. And this is why liberal democracy is promoted officially by the U.S. government and corporations, because that creates a weak state, a divided state that can be very easily manipulated to permit foreign banks and foreign corporations to take up root there and destroy their local competition. For St. Paisius, ethnicity derives from common territory and a language, but even that is rooted in religion. And when those are all together, you add history as the subjective element, and then you have revolution and you have liberation. That's the point. And this is what the Turks, the Fanar Greeks, the Soviets, the Americans, the British Empire, this is what they feared more than anything else in the world. There is no nation without religion. There's no nation you could point to that doesn't have a religious identity at its core. It's very rare to find a multi-religious nation that's been successful and natural. You know, we usually think of nations. I mean, there's always minorities. I don't mean that. At the core of the nation usually is one religion. When that's threatened, the nation itself is threatened. If you read all of the saints and martyrs, in the Ukrainian and Ruthenian attacks on the Unions in the 17th century, they all make the claim that the nation and religion are one and the same. To be Orthodox is to be Ukrainian. To be Ukrainian is to be Orthodox. To become Roman Catholic or even a Union is to become a Pole. So talk about, you know, nationalism as this modern concept is false. Connected with the state is also false. And that is, you can't have the national order with Orthodoxy is ridiculous. The fact that we are divided into ethnic churches, canonically, generally suggests that ethnicity is centrally important, and this is the reason why. St. Paisius, of course, has what we call the primordial view of nationalism, of nations, that they have always existed. Just like the individual, they're born, they grow up, they change, they thrive, they decay, and they die sometimes. Just like a person. Just like any individual, we borrow from others, we take from others. You know, none of that vitiates our individuality. And nations are no different. Families are no different. I've actually gotten the argument, actually quite often, that because nations borrow from others, they're not real independent nations. And I said, and I asked them, well, what language are you speaking? You didn't create English, did you? The clothes that you wear, the concept, the very argument that you're using against me, did you invent all that? No, that comes from others. Therefore, according to your argument, you're not an individual. It's stupid. It, one of these things that have a, that has a prima facie plausibility that goes away the minute you think for 2.5 seconds. But thinking is a problem. And that's why the histories were burnt. Peter the Great, I want to also, I said this before, also burnt the histories of local principalities in Russia as well to justify his centralization of power in St. Petersburg. He tried to destroy old Russian history. So whenever you have a globalized state power, not a nation, not a culture, but a civilization, you have an intense hatred for history. And what the rulers usually do is figure out some way to suppress it, to burn it, to destroy it. And they almost always fail. St. Paisius says they have failed, and so he traveled throughout the Balkans, as well as Mount Athos, collecting all the surviving histories that he possibly could. And that's why his history of Bulgaria was so immensely significant. It was the earliest ethnic history of the era of the Balkans, and done deliberately to irritate the Finar Greeks and Jews, who would then deny the very existence of the Bulgarian nation. Needless to say, his books were banned, he was condemned, the man's a saint anyway, proving that condemnation, that kind of stuff, is absolutely meaningless, especially when it's done for all the wrong reasons, like it was in this case. The Greeks who served the Turkish state were the enemy, according to St. Paisius. Local strongmen, you know, the minute the Turkish Empire began to wane after his death, what began to happen is, well, two things. You had peasant societies develop on a religious and ethnic basis and develop networks throughout the country. The second thing that happened was that as the Sultan began to fade, local strongmen and military men, loyal to the Turkish idea, then took over. And that's where it got nasty. In many ways, the revolutionaries didn't see the Sultan as that bad of a guy. Because the Sultan saw those local strongmen just as problematic as the revolutionaries did. Remember, the Exarchate first came out of the Turkish office. It was the Greeks that talked him out of it and condemned it. And Paisius is correct that the enemy is the Greeks, because the Greeks were put in charge of the so-called Orthodox millet. And the Greek language was the only one permitted in the church throughout the Balkans, regardless of the language of the population. And this means that ignorance began to grow and grow and grow, and St. Paisius mentions it explicitly, as does the Kolevadis fathers from Mount Athos at the same time. The Kolevadis fathers were anathematized in 1775 and excommunicated in 1776. So there is definitely a pattern here. And these men continued to function as clergy and priests. It didn't matter, because they realized that this man was a simoniac, that he was responding to bribes, and that a lot of it wasn't entirely his fault. But they had to leave Athos because the Patriarchate is the owner of it. The moment his book was published, the Greeks at the Phanar went orbital. "There is no Bulgaria," they screamed. "It doesn't exist. It's your invention. It's an imagined community." A very postmodern response from the Phanar. This is occurring in the middle of the 18th century, though. The Greeks and the Turks worked symbiotically. And, of course, I don't want to leave the Jews out, because the Jews were really the ruling class in the Turkish Empire. The Fan Army really split between the two groups, and some Jews taking Greek names, so it's hard to tell the difference. But their reaction is no different from the anti-nationalist Marxists of today. But the Greeks were the enemy because they were the ones who were used as Orthodox people to destroy the local national shrines and replace them with Greek ones, loyal to Turkey. So Greeks, elite Greeks, I mean, I don't mean peasant Greeks. I don't mean lower clergy. Elite Greeks were seen as nothing more than paid and bribed agents of the Turkish Empire. There's people out there who don't know that a non-European, non-white power was a colonial overlord for half of Europe for 400 years. That these people were all under the Turkish Empire, and contrary to mythology, there was no cultural accommodation. There was mass forced conversions all over the place, and not just indirectly. There are many new martyrs to the Turkish yoke. The difference was that, like the British rather than the French, they used intermediaries. Those intermediaries were the Greeks. The Greeks were the elite Greeks were the servants of the empire, as were the Jews, and they were rewarded handsomely. Keep in mind that Jews were the official executioners of the Ottoman state. They were also the tax gatherers of the Ottoman state, and so they had military protection for extracting rents from the population. The other significance of a piece of aspect of significance here is that the book says that the common people, the people as a whole, is a subject of history. Not necessarily kings and rulers. He talks about that at some length, but it's the nation that is itself an individual that is the subject of history. The people are history. They are historical. He says that the minute the national particularity is destroyed, slavery is the result. St. Paisius' nationalism was primordial, it was political, it was revolutionary, it was strictly Orthodox, and he saw no difference among those terms. National liberation is no different than the liberation of asceticism for a monk. And the work of not only reaching your independence, but maintaining it, is the same thing as your autonomy as a man, not allowing the passions to rule, but using your reason through grace to think properly. Throughout, really because of his work, he had students all over the place. The Bulgarian National Awakening in the 19th century came into existence because of the weakening of the Sultan's power, the rise of the strongmen, and the peasant societies. Local strongmen even used mercenaries with Fanar money. They used Tartar troops quite often. They had to be, you know, essentially non-white and non-Christian to go in and kill as many of these people as possible to terrorize them. It was the Russian Empire, using Cossacks primarily, that began smashing pieces of the Turkish Empire such that the Sultan had to let go, at least to some extent, of the Balkans. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, often using the Serbian paramilitaries as their main force, was also forcing the Turks out of the Balkans. But it was a seesaw battle. And when they retook an area, the Turks retook an area, they slaughtered mercilessly. And they would bring in the Jews and Tartars and others, because it's much easier to kill when they're not your people. So many of the Ottoman ruling class were in fact Jews. Rauf Bey, who was the Sultan's adjunct, Ismail Bey was the first chamberlain at this period of time. Abuluçaman Hudi was the head of the police in the Balkans at the time. The governor of Jerusalem was usually a Jew. Ibrahim Ithud was the head of the Council of State in this period of time. They all took Turkish-sounding names. All were Jews. Jews were fanatically loyal to the Islamic State. I mean, I'm sorry, to the Ottoman state. Islam, to a great extent, is a form of Judaism. They're so similar, it's almost ridiculous. But what began to happen is that using these Jewish elites, then hiring with Fanar money foreign troops to slaughter Bulgarians and Serbs, especially Bulgaria. Bulgaria was the closest because, first of all, it opens out into the Black Sea and is does border the Ottoman state directly. So Bulgaria was extremely important. It was also fairly large. And thanks to St. Paisius, had a very strong national and ethnic consciousness. The reprisals of these people is what caught the attention of Western Europe. Now, the problem wasn't so much that they gave a damn whether or not Slavic peasants were killed. They did a lot of that themselves. It gave them an excuse to begin taking over a tottering Ottoman Empire. Remember, the last 100 years of the Ottoman state existed because it was being artificially propped up by Britain and France. The situation was, thanks to St. Paisius, the revolutions in Bulgaria and elsewhere were driving the Turks out of the area. No state can exist because local strongmen were able to take over. They're absolutely outrageous and insane behavior, using non-whites to slaughter them and Jewish money to pay them. Outraged a lot of people. The point is, though, the outrage wasn't over their deaths. It wasn't over human rights abuses or nonsense like that. The outrage is that Russia seemed to be winning. Because these are Orthodox states, they look to Russia as a protector. Russia's and the Cossack victories over the Turks and the Tartars is what created the room that they had to function in the first place. And that had to stop. Therefore, the British and the French essentially took over the Ottoman state. And by the time World War I broke out, the Ottoman state was a central power, and so German officers were actually commanding Turkish forces, both on the sea and on land. In the 18th century, Januarius McGann, who was a journalist both for London Daily News and New York Daily News, claimed that 100,000 Bulgarians were slaughtered in these reprisals throughout the 18th century. The official histories on both sides say it was between 40 and 60,000. Now, very few of these slaughters were done by regular troops. I've said many times on this show that people just don't kill innocent people. This is why the Jewish connection is so important. Because that level of hatred, remember the Middle Ages, the Khazars were Antichrist. They were an absolutely savage, violent force that would stop at nothing for victory. They didn't obey any rules of war. You know, this is why the Khazar Empire was essentially the synonym for evil and death in the Middle Ages. A little fact that's been repressed quite a bit. And their descendants, and the Jews and the Fanar, and Jewish money, this is, and they were used, and were commanding infantry. Irregulars, of course, but commanding infantry that ended up slaughtering entire villages. The French and Russian consulate in the Ottoman Empire, as well as in Bulgaria, say it's well over 100,000 civilians, and these units were commanded by Jews. The uprising of Stara Gorna in 1751 really came into existence because of Jewish taxation. And therefore, Jews were used to command the reprisal squads. Bulgarian merchants, both in the 18th and 19th century, thanks to people like St. Paisius, building up the national consciousness, were in fact making inroads. Not only in the Slavic areas, but even in Greece itself. Many of these uprisings were the result of previous reprisals. The Jewish role in the Fanar was not only as bankers, but also as intelligence throughout the Balkans, figuring out what units are loyal and what units are not. They would then go back and tell on people who and would never, you know, when these reprisals occurred, they would never take them in. They would never protect them. They allowed them to be slaughtered. And so the Basi Bazouks was the name of the irregular forces of the Turkish army. They were not paid. They were from all over the Third World. They were not paid at all, so they had to live off what they could steal. The April Uprising, 1877-1878, was against Jewish control. These Basi Bazouks had strong Khazar elements to them and Tartar elements to them. And these were the ones that were that came in and often high on hash is what they were known for, would slaughter anything in their path. Now, there are some Bulgarian historians, Dmitry Ilkov, Daskal Ivanov, Dmitry Lashiev, who say that there were ritual killings at the time. They state that crucifixion was used for these reprisals, particularly Orthodox reprisals, obviously, you know, against the Orthodox people. And that eyewitnesses say that rabbis would come and collect blood in these bronze containers, and that even visible altars would be set up for these people to be sacrificed. I can't, you know, obviously mainstream press isn't going to talk about this at all, but some of this stuff did make its way into the foreign press at the time. And you have fairly substantial eyewitness reports of this. I'm not saying it's absolutely the case, but it's, you know, you have three journalists and historians who say it happened. And given the immense Jewish power in the Ottoman Empire and their control over some of these Abbasi Bazouk units, there is some sense that slaughtering Christians and supporting Islam, just as they do today in Europe, is almost a sacrificial route into power. There are many historians, many people who I've just mentioned, do speak of Jewish organized crime, Jewish underground mafia, who controlled trade. The deputy chief treasurer in the empire was always Jewish. Solomon the Magnificent brought in one of the most powerful Spanish Jewish banking houses, led by Alvaro Mendez, because when the Inquisition kicked the Jews out of Spain, the Islamic Empire brought them in fact, invited them in. Bayezid II, Sultan, invited specifically, sent out the invitation for Jews to come and settle within the Ottoman Empire and take over their finances. Rabbi Isaac Zarfi said that gold and silver in the empire is all in our hands. And so when I say Jewish mafia, I mean, that's the term that was kind of used at the time. And throughout the, you know, the classic period of Ottoman control in the Balkans, about 250,000 Jews from Iberia were settled in the Ottoman state, and they did take over much of the actions of the Fanar. So so many of these so-called Greeks were Jews. Now you had others, students of St. Paisius, like Metropolitan Clement of Trnava, who died in 1901. His real name was Vasil Drume. Metropolitan Clement was a direct student, not personally, but through his works, of St. Paisius. And he continued to refer to Bulgarian folk life as the essence not only of the state, but also the church. The point of history, the point of writing history, and takes us directly from Paisius, is to offer us examples so that when we come across them in our daily life, we know who to avoid, who to follow, who to ignore. That there is no difference between the past and the present. The present is just a manifestation of the past. They're all one. Metropolitan Clement writes very clearly that national development has to be based on the specific circumstances, that's a direct quote, of the nation in question. Coming from the school of St. Paisius, Metropolitan Clement of Trnava speaks of this confluence of topography, and historical experience, producing language, and then being crystallized in religion as the very nature of a nation. That's the objective part of it. Education is not just of the mind in quantitative sciences, but also in the qualitative education of the heart, which comes from the national whole. It comes from the environment, not necessarily the free will. Metropolitan of Trnova will say that the single greatest sin and betrayal is the betrayal of your nation. Because your devotion is to the brotherhood first, and to those that you can actually have an effect on, people around you speaking the same language. This is your brethren. It is unnatural for you to profit at their expense. Because again, that's what the Fanar does, that's what the Jews do. And this derives from the fact that the family is the basic unit of society. According to Metropolitan Clement, the nation is primordial because it comes from a connection of families over time. And what he means is, of course, the extended family, we would call the clan today, interacting in such a way that a much larger unit is created over time. And as they suffer, as they experience both good and bad times, they're then molded and welded into a unit. Nationalism affects the heart. Of course, it's rational, but that's not all it is. It affects the heart in the same sense that love for the family comes from the heart. The heart is deeper than the mind. The heart includes the mind. He even says that major media is irresponsible and has to be controlled by the folk, in one form or another. It cannot report based on the self-interest of those who own it, which is a very modern thing to say. The nation, finally, in his mentality, the nation comes from pain. I've been saying this for many, many years, and here you have Orthodox people writing as so-called philotism is being condemned by the Fanar, that our knowledge, the subjective awareness of our nationhood, even of our personhood, comes from pain, comes from suffering. The Bulgarian nation is stronger because of this foreign occupation. Of course, Orthodoxy is based on universal truths, but it's more than just words on a page. It speaks to people in a very specific language. The Greeks turned on the idea of nationalism, and the Greeks of the Fanar, I mean, following the Jewish example, the clans like the Mendez clan, because it was fashionable, because they earned money as a result of it. Another one is Metropolitan Methodius Kuster, who died in 1922. He was armed and part of the uprisings against the Turks, the later uprisings against the Turks in the late 19th century. Freedom is a result of understanding and being able to judge properly your national environment. It's all based on language in the broad sense. Man naturally seeks God, but there is no thought outside of language. Therefore, man seeks God naturally within the national enclosure. This is why language is so important. This is why the mission of St. Cyril and Methodius in translating the services into the native language is so important. And this is why the Roman Catholic Church was so deadly wrong in refusing any language but Latin. The nation is not based just on formalities like, you know, experience and topography. That is its essential foundation. But the heart is more than that. The self, whether it be the national self or yourself as a person, maintains its objective awareness no matter what changes. We're aware of ourselves as such, no matter what's going on around, no matter how much we change or we grow or whatever, meaning that there is something that persists through time that is our essence, and that is the soul, and, of course, can't be material. Paul Methodius says that really all politics is religious, and all religion is political. This is why the Old Testament's in the Bible. It is a profoundly political and legal book. It's there for a reason. It's not there for entertainment or to make the Bible look bigger. There's a reason it's much bigger than the New Testament. To be free in the sense of autonomy can only be done within an environment where you see yourself in the other. The other isn't a stranger anymore. He's an extension of yourself, and you only find that when you look alike and sound alike and talk alike and have the same basic fundamental things in common. Otherwise, they're strangers, and if they're strangers, you can't trust them, and no social action can take place. And the only people who benefit from that are foreign overlords. He states further that the only reason that wealth comes to somebody is for the public good. Like all Orthodox people, there is nothing you need beyond the basics. Basics for your work and day-to-day life and family. Anything else goes to the people. It doesn't go to the state necessarily. It goes to the people. You use it to build up others. That's why you have it. They don't believe in equality of outcome. They don't believe in equality of ability because they're not half-wits. They do realize, though, that inequality of finances in an age of total monetization of everything is a deadly sin. In a different era, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. But since everything is measured by money, the point of some people having it is to use it for others. Your right to money above and beyond what you need is based on how it is used. There is no abstract right to property. And the way to use it is to assist the brotherhood. And the brotherhood is the Orthodox nation, the Orthodox people. Because really, they're you. Because you are one family. Because there was a certain social cohesion and order that permitted you to make this money, in a certain sense, it does belong to them. You didn't make this on your own. There was an entire context involved in it. You could work hard your entire life and end up with nothing. You could do nothing and end up being a billionaire. That's simply how it goes. That has nothing to do with rationality or justice or reason. Your possession of money or assets is perfectly okay. But it has to be used for the sake of the brotherhood. It has to be used for the sake of the improvement of people. Now, today in America, you remember, it was maybe 10 years ago, maybe more, Warren Buffett and Bill Gates gave something like $10 billion or more to so-called charities. They never listed what these are, by the way. Turns out these are left-wing political bodies that call themselves charities. Not only do these people not have to pay taxes because of this, but in essence, they bought these organizations. When you give that much money to them, you control them. And I don't know how much this is actually used to help people. I give a small amount every month on my credit card goes to the Ronald McDonald House and St. Jude's Children's Hospital because almost 100% of that money goes to the cause. I know this for an absolute fact. But that's not the case with a group of people like, you know, Oxfam, all these other stupid groups, Amnesty International, that these people bought with their money. And the press in unison praised them for their incredible generosity and said this should be an example to you, American, who has nothing, should give to these people as well. These weren't charities. These are political organizations. They didn't give anything. They bought something. This is not what we're talking about. Why wouldn't these people give directly to individuals? There's certainly plenty of people in Omaha who could use the money that Warren Buffett gave to Oxfam or some group like that. Why didn't he just do that? Well, Metropolitan Methodius Khrushchev in Bulgaria says that, I believe he was Bishop of Varna on the coast, that this is not what we mean by charity. You're giving directly to individuals for a specific purpose. And when you receive that money, it is not yours. It is God's. When I personally receive a donation, I do not treat that as my personal money. I treat that as God's money. That is given to me for a very specific purpose, to maintain my research, this show, my writing, etc. And not a penny that I've ever raised has gone to anything else. Not something that's extremely sacred to me. It has to be. That's not my money. And as the Metropolitan here would say, it's not your money. The money belongs to God. It belongs to the church. And therefore has to be treated accordingly. So, this is a small indication of the nature of Bulgarian nationalism based on the writings of St. Paisius the Philotist. And the ingredients that you have here are very clear. You have foreign occupation. You have Jewish involvement. You have the use of local elites, Greeks, to control peasants and craftsmen. I also should note, by the way, that St. Paisius condemned vehemently the life of the merchant as the lowest form of life. They produce nothing. They're essentially middlemen who manipulate people to buy things they don't need. Now, of course, at the time, this was almost universal. Today, the merchant is you know, a successful businessman. But back then, it was the lowest form of life. They don't mean tradesmen necessarily. They mean merchants. And that would include loan sharks. This confluence of things is very much like we have today. Destroying the national idea means burning the history books, either literally or figuratively. I'm telling you now that now doing this stuff full time for 28 years, January 1st, 1990, is when I started this mission. Everything that the average educated American believes about the world is wrong. I don't know how I can even talk to these people anymore. Everything they believe is wrong. I don't care what the subject is. Even the language that they use to describe it is incorrect. They don't know how to ask the right questions, let alone how to come up with the proper answer. When you study the writings of the fathers and actual real history, you, especially when I learned to read Russian, everything changed because I saw a totally different world. Everything they think they know about any political, social, economic topic is false. The numbers that they quote at you usually are wrong, or manipulated in such a way that they don't fully understand. Nothing has changed. In the Balkans, the time of St. Paisius, the Greeks were being used by the Turks to destroy churches, to take them over, to impose the Greek world onto a group of people who didn't want it. They burnt the Bulgarian histories, anywhere they could find it, and then condemned them for being ignorant. You see that today with poor rural people. White rural people, the only people you can mock and get away with it today. And yet we know that the New World Order is directly responsible for their condition. It's no different there. They make these people ignorant and then mock them for the result. That you had this kept group of multimillionaires at the Fanar who control the Patriarchate and use the so-called prestige of that body to promote their own agenda. They bought and sold anathemas and condemnations. You had to pay a lot of money to get one of those. All the sees were for a very large fee, and it was a regularized fee. Therefore, none of these bishops were legitimate. Most of them weren't even bishops. Can you name really a single Balkan bishop of the 18th century? I can only name Ambrose from the, went with the Old Believers. That's pretty much it. These were non-entities. You know, you'd have to really go and search for someone because there are actually very few legitimate bishops at the time. St. Ambrose was being kicked out of his see because he refused to pay the loan sharks back. We end up leading the Old Believers in Belokranica and Bosnia, from Bosnia. You could hardly name any of these people. The church had decayed, but the people kept it alive. This is the people who St. Paisius was talking about, not only talking to, but also talking about. They are the history of the nation. Without them, you have absolutely nothing. This man was a revolutionary. This man changed the way that the world viewed nations and peoples. And as a result, the elites of the day condemned him and exiled him and threatened him in every way possible. And now today, he is a saint. Thank God. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.